report will now call Professional Association of Golf Officials versus Phillips Campbell et al. The mayor, please support Mr. Christian Denny to argue for the appellant and Mr. Michael Yano to argue for the appellant.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the court, counsel, briefing counsel. My name is Christian Denny of Barlow, Garsick, and Simon here in Fort Worth. I'm going to argue on behalf of the Professional Association of Golf Officials. Commonly, my client is known as PAGO, so I'll probably be referring to him as PAGO throughout the discussion today. We're here today on an appeal of a special appearance that was granted in favor of the appellees. I think it would be helpful to get a framework of the facts of the case, if the court so allows. There was some, I guess, lack of better terms, misinformation, miscommunication, apparently, in the facts of the case, and I want to make sure we're all on the same playing field. Basically, this relationship at issue started in 1992 or 93 when a gentleman named Richie Phillips started PAGO. Richie Phillips was a longtime lawyer that represented officials and referee bodies. Sometime later, Richie Phillips' law firm became Phillips Campbell and Phillips, and Richie Phillips became incapacitated and actually recently passed away. When he became incapacitated, Patrick Campbell took over the representation of PAGO. When Mr. Campbell took over that representation, my clients felt that the representation went downhill. Some of the issues that we'll discuss later, Mr. Campbell and Phillips Campbell and Phillips had complete control of my client's bank accounts. Every dollar of association dues went to Phillips Campbell and Phillips. All was controlled by Pat Campbell, which ultimately ended up Mr. Campbell manipulating the membership and removing certain members. The main point of this case, where the damages really are, ultimately come from an agreement that was entered into in 2007. It was a collective bargaining agreement between PAGO and PGA Tour, Inc., which is the PGA Tour. There was an agreement for them to have a collective bargaining agreement running from January 1, 07 to December 31st, 2011. In 2010, during the term of the agreement, not a new negotiation, not a new collective bargaining agreement, but during the term, there was a unilateral change by the PGA Tour that did away with my client's car benefit. Part of the car benefit is a basis of compensation. Compensation is a matter that has to be negotiated in collective bargaining. It's one of the mandatory subjects of bargaining. In 2010, it was indicated this benefit is going to go away during the term. There was a December 2010 board meeting that lasted 2 days, December 13th and 14th, that occurred here in Texas, where Mr. Campbell and the board and the members of PAGO discussed the loss of this benefit. It also included first class travel and some other things. The loss of this benefit is a huge deal. It's a lot of money each year. It's for every official multiplied times 27. It's a big deal. During this discussion, there was actually a phone conversation where Pat Campbell got on the phone with Allison Keller, who's one of the tour's negotiators, and discussed that benefit and the loss of that benefit and how it would be treated. Ultimately, he comes back into the board meeting and tells PAGO, look, we don't need to grieve this. We need to let it go. We need to maintain this relationship. Let it go. That's a big deal, because by not grieving it, they lost the benefit. It's gone, because you have, under the collective bargaining agreement, a certain period of time to grieve that loss. It was waived. That was ultimately discussed via telephonic board meeting, phone calls. It was also discussed with the membership via letter, email, other telephone calls that continued. Those items happen in the state of Texas. Ultimately, PAGO decided we need to separate. We need to go in a different direction. We're going to break away from Pat Campbell. There's a retainer agreement that was entered into evidence. It was a part of, I think, both parties' appendix in this case. agreement, the retainer agreement, ran along with the collective bargaining agreement, which means it ended in December 31st, 2011, and began on January 1st, 2007. There's a provision in that agreement that allows for PAYGO to terminate within 180 days of termination. That was done in May 2011. All of the services were terminated by Pat Campbell, for Pat Campbell and Phillips Campbell and Phillips Rendering on behalf of PAYGO. After that point, Pat Campbell came to this organization that by that time was a Texas organization and demanded.
When did that happen?
When did it become a Texas organization? June 1st, 2011.
Okay.
So then Pat Campbell demands $100,000+ for work performed in 2012. Now, granted, this was June of 2011, but he wanted money for the year 2012 for representation. Then he refused to provide any of the books and records, any of the bank account information, any of its filings, all of these items that are very important to running an organization and are required to be kept by the Department of Labor, which included a proof of a fidelity bond. When you submit your LM3, your labor management report every year, you have to say yes or no whether you have a fidelity bond or a labor bond. They could not even say whether they had one or not because Mr. Campbell would not release the information. All they knew is from years past, being able to get it through open records, that there was a fidelity bond. That's important because duties for lawyers continue after termination. There was also evidence in the record that Mr. Campbell continued to communicate with management, which is the opposition in a collective bargaining setting, after he was terminated about PAYGO business. So PAYGO goes into negotiating a new term with the PGA Tour without its files, without its records, and their former attorney communicating with management about their business. That's the fact background of this case. That's where we're going. Under the lawsuit, we were suing for negligence, breach of fiduciary duty, and various declarations based on the retainer agreement. The biggest point at issue is what is required to be proved in a special appearance by the appellees. When the appellees challenge a special appearance, they have the duty, they have the requirement, the burden to negate all the basis of jurisdiction. Pretty clear. I think both parties agree on that. That's the law. The law from the Texas Supreme Court, that's the law from this court. Well, in the third amended petition, PAYGO introduced 28 bases for jurisdiction. Now, some of which, obviously, they discussed in their evidence. Many of which we believe they do not, or they agreed that certain bases of jurisdiction were there. They agree that there was a Texas board meeting here, and it was actually in McKinney. They didn't say there was the first date, because we argued that it was both December 13th and 14th, but they agree it's certainly December 14, 2010. There was a board meeting in McKinney discussing union business that ultimately was the subject of this lawsuit. What they never discussed in any of the evidence was these telephonic board meetings. The practice was that there would be these meetings telephonically because the members of PAYGO are throughout the United States. One of the pertinent important members is the Vice President, Rich Pearson, who is here in Texas, was a party to those conversations and discussions at his home in Texas. Also,
and how continuous and systematic were these board meetings telephonically?
How often did they occur?
I'm trying to throw in some legal buzzwords. How continuous and systematic were these telephonic board meetings?
Yeah. What the evidence was is they're not sporadic, but they're on an as-needed basis. So when this matter occurred, I believe the evidence was that there were a lot of conversations and telephonic board meetings occurring right there, right around the time of the discussion, right there in December 2010 into January of 2011 is where, you know, the basis of these, you know, vehicle, travel, car insurance discussions were occurring.
So you're saying every member who was a part of that telephonic discussion, whatever state they were in, you could bring a lawsuit in that state?
For the board members specifically, And it was more than just those telephonic board meetings. There were also additional meetings, emails, written correspondence, and communication with other members in Texas. I believe there were four total members in Texas. So it's not isolated just to one individual. This was a continuing practice because this was a huge deal for these guys. These are guys aren't making millions of dollars. They're normal people. And if you lose a $10,000 benefit, there's going to be a lot of discussion. And
that's what happened. How many people are on the board?
The board has seven members.
Seven members. So just because they were residents of Texas and they communicated with them by email and by telephone, your position is that that's a continuous and systematic contact with the state of Texas that means they can be hailed into this state and sued.
I think it's the multiple components. I mean, there are several cases that I can cite to. The Glencoe Capital case talks about telephonic board meetings. Then you have the Haggerty Partners case out of Dallas that talks about one single board member having a single contact. Then you have,
those were also Texas organizations, weren't they?
The Glencoe Capital case involved an Illinois organization. I believe how it was is the general partner of the limited partner was an Illinois company, was how that was. I think there was one plaintiff that happened to be, or two plaintiffs that happened to be Texas residents, individuals.
Is legal advice being proffered during these meetings?
Yes, that's the most important point.
What you're trying to say is that if a lawyer out of state continuously and systematically gives legal advice to a client in Texas, he should be expected to be hailed into a Texas court if there's some litigation over that legal advice.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the case I go back to, there's a couple cases, the Cartledge versus Hernandez case out of Houston addressed a specific point on that relating to letters and progress reports being sent to a client in Texas by an out-of-state lawyer. Here we have an individual that's interpreting a collective bargaining agreement, giving advice on the grievance process, and ultimately advising not to go through the grievance process, which is a form of litigation. It ultimately ends up in arbitration under the collective bargaining agreement. All that advice the genesis of that advice started here in Texas. The communication with the PGA Tour and Allison Keller occurred here in Texas. Ultimately, discussing the matter with the membership, this matter was discussed with members in the state of Texas, including board members. So, I mean, it's a continuation. It's not a single contact. The appellees try to make it look like some attenuated, periodic, sporadic behavior. This is a very solid piece of time, a two-month piece of time, where this is going on bang, bang, bang. Board meeting, telephone calls, board meeting via telephonic communication, emails, written correspondence. You have testimony from four individuals that said, we were communicated with. I was in the state of Texas. All of this started in the state of Texas. That's where the advice was. That brought him here into these courts. I think you have minimum contacts. I think you have continuous and systematic contacts because it's a history. I mean, even the Moki Mac case, which went a different direction based on what the evidence was, but there was some conversation in that case indicating that channels of regular communication could find four minimum contacts. So that's exactly what we have here. We have a continuing pattern of providing this advice in a certain way. Ultimately, he's compensated for it. He had the benefit. The operative facts, or as the Glencoe Capital case said, the core of the claim happened here. Ultimately, after he was terminated, we have a Texas association that can't get its records and to this day doesn't have its bank account information or its fidelity bond information. A group here can't operate a business because you can't get the information from the lawyer who doesn't want to give it to them. So that's where the genesis and the core of the complaint is, and it certainly doesn't violate any fair play or substantial injustice for a law firm to come to Texas to litigate. I mean, the cases on law firms coming to Texas are pretty clear. They say a small firm traveling to Texas is not that big of a deal. I mean, the role in Rolling and Rolling case out of Austin, the Glencoe Capital case out of this court, said the very same thing. With modern transportation and all the issues that go along with that, it's not a problem to come litigate in Texas. With that, you have this history. And the other point that I wanted to make is there's some discussion on what the standard of review is. The findings of fact listed out several items and ultimately had one conclusion of law that there was no personal jurisdiction. In the section on findings of fact, there were things like appellees did not have minimum contacts. That's a conclusion of law. So that's challenged de novo. That the that there wasn't purposeful conduct, that is also a conclusion of law, not a finding of fact, and would be challenged de novo.
All right, Counselor, I believe your light has been extinguished, so.
Thank you.
We'll let you continue here in a few minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Yanoff, and I represent the appellees, Phillips Campbell and Phillips, and Patrick Campbell. I'll start by saying this, because it was referenced a number of times. The Glencoe case, the plaintiff was a Texas resident, the individual plaintiff was a Texas resident, and the corporation was a Texas resident. So, lest there be any doubt, Glencoe, Travel Jungle, Fish, Mountain States, the primary cases relied on by PAYGO, they each involved Texas residents. Now, they involved different levels of contacts, no doubt, and I'll talk about those, but they all involved Texas residents. Justice McCoy, you asked the question, how continuous and systematic were these telephonic board meetings? The answer you received is, as needed. I don't know how that can be interpreted as continuous and systematic. That seems sporadic to me.
Well, if they're as needed weekly, I would say it was continuous and systematic.
That's not what the evidence shows. Right. The evidence shows that there was a telephonic board meeting on a given occasion that a certain board member may have been from Texas. It doesn't say that he was sitting in Texas or she was sitting in Texas for the telephonic board meeting. It does say they were a Texas resident. There may be another instance where there was a telephonic board meeting. What is clear is from the evidence.
How many telephonic board meetings were there?
It's not clear from the evidence. There is at least one to two referenced in an affidavit. It's not clear whether that's a single board meeting or multiple telephonic board meetings.
All right. So your position is there was one live board meeting and one or two telephonic board meetings?
Well, there were as needed board meetings. I'm not disputing that.
You don't know then.
But the evidence itself references a couple of them.
All right. So the evidence only represents a live one and one or two telephonic ones.
Yes.
Okay.
PAYGO's counsel said the main point of this case is the 2007 collective bargaining agreement and negotiation of it. The undisputed evidence is in 2007, when that collective bargaining agreement was negotiated, PAYGO was a Pennsylvania association. Phillips Campbell and Phillips was a Pennsylvania law firm, and the collective bargaining agreement was negotiated entirely outside of Texas.
Well, I understood him to say the main issue was the loss of this car issue that occurred in 2010, the end of 2010, I think.
Well, the way that arises is from the 2007 collective bargaining agreement. To the extent the tour unilaterally chose to do that, that can't be an allegation against the law firm that the tour chose to unilaterally do something.
The allegation is you gave them bad legal advice by not advising that they grieve that loss.
And that legal advice over the years, except for the single board meeting, I'll get to that in a second, but except for that single board meeting, in-person board meeting, all occurred from Pennsylvania. Until June of 2011, after PAYGO had terminated the attorney-client relationship, PAYGO was next door to the law firm in Pennsylvania. PAYGO was set up by the law firm. They existed in Pennsylvania. The National Labor Relations Board proceedings occurred in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The law firm helped them with that. And the negotiation occurred all outside of Texas. There is a single specific jurisdictional fact in this case, if there is to be a specific jurisdictional fact. And PAYGO kind of blurs the lines on what's specific and what's general, but as this court well knows, the standards are different. It's purposeful availment for specific jurisdiction. It is continuous and systematic for general jurisdiction. And it's not simply any jurisdictional fact that you can allege gets you there and gets you there the same way. The only arguable specific jurisdictional fact is the single board meeting in December of 2010. And here's what the evidence shows.
What about the however many there were telephonic board meetings? Are you suggesting that those don't count? Give legal advice to a Texan over the phone and that somehow play a part in jurisdiction?
Well, case after case, it says that the attorney-client relationship itself and communications over the phone by email and correspondence are not sufficient in and of themselves. Now, there's certainly instances where a particular contract is negotiated in the forum state, even though it may be foreign residents. But it's negotiated within the state, and the lawsuit itself relates to that contract. That can invoke jurisdiction even though it's foreign residence. That's the Fish case. But that's not what we have here. The contract itself is this collective bargaining agreement. To simply have telephonic board meetings or send correspondence or send emails or even generally have a passive website that may go outside into the state, I'm not aware of a case finding jurisdiction in those instances. And as the chart shows, case after case says those are insufficient to invoke jurisdiction, either under specific or general jurisdiction. So we have the December 2010 board meeting, and here's what the evidence is clear, that a lawyer from Phillips, Campbell & Phillips attended that board meeting. Now, there's some dispute about whether it was one day or 2 days, but it was a single board meeting over 2 days. And for these purposes, let's say it was a two-day board meeting. Here's what the evidence shows. Phillips Campbell had nothing to do with picking the location of this meeting, and it was not chosen based on PAYGO having some connection to Texas, because PAYGO was still in Pennsylvania at this time. The bylaws for PAYGO say that the board chooses the place of the board meeting. The lawyer doesn't choose it, nobody chooses it except for the board. And the evidence shows that this meeting place was chosen for one simple reason, because it's in the middle of the country and it's easy to get to. It's a central geographic location. And that, to me, is the very essence of a random, fortuitous contact into the forum state. It happened to take place in Texas because it was an easy place to fly into and probably a fun place to come to. But it's simply a place chosen by the board of PAYGO, who's located in Pennsylvania. The organization's still in Pennsylvania at this time. The law firm's in Pennsylvania. They chose to set it at this setting. The president has the most input per the bylaws, and he's never been in Texas. That's clear from the evidence. And they chose Dallas for a two-day meeting, and the lawyer came down for the meeting. Did they talk business? I assume they did. The evidence shows that they talked some business at that meeting. Now, they didn't talk about negotiating the 2007 collective bargaining agreement that's the basis of the bad advice that they're talking about, or the relationship faltered, because that happened 3 years earlier, and that didn't happen in Texas. And so for specific jurisdiction, they have a two-day board meeting that is randomly selected to be in Texas per the bylaws from the board simply because it's a central meeting place. That is not specific jurisdiction. That is random and fortuitous. For general jurisdiction, they open it up a little bit more and say written statements and correspondence were sent to PAYGO members. And by the way, some of those happen to live in Texas. There were emails sent. And by the way, some of those members live in Texas. And there were phone calls, these periodic meetings on the phone, I guess. And some of those members live in Texas. Now, the evidence does not show that they were sitting in Texas for the phone calls, but I'm not sure that really matters. Case after case after case, from this court, Gordon and Doner, Geo Chevron, Myers, Credit Commercial, Freudensprung, they're all in the chart. Moki Mac, IRA resources, they've all held the same thing. Contacts like that are passive, and they do not invoke general jurisdiction. There is one single United States Supreme Court case to find general jurisdiction. In the history of the United States Supreme Court, as many decades as they've been talking about general and specific jurisdiction, there's a single case, and it's the Perkins case. And in the Perkins case, the contacts they said were sufficient to invoke general jurisdiction was a foreign corporation whose president moved to a forum state. He moved there and he ran his business continuously for an extended period of time from the forum state. So every contact he had while he was running the company from the forum state was inside out. It was inside the forum state and outward. And on that one instance, the United States Supreme Court said that is sufficient for general jurisdiction because it was an extended period of time, i.e. continuous, and it was systematic. He was running the company as a plan from the forum state. And it makes sense that general jurisdiction could be invoked and be found in that instance. But on contacts far greater than here, in Helicopteros, the United States Supreme Court said it was not sufficient to negotiate in the forum state. Helicopteros was actually, Texas was the jurisdiction. Negotiate in the state, enter into a contract with a state company to build helicopters, send your people to the forum state to be trained there, and ultimately have those helicopters built in the forum state. Now, the problem was in that case, the helicopter crash occurred in South America. It did not occur in the forum state, or it would have been specific jurisdiction. But in that instance, the United States Supreme Court said that is not sufficient because they are not continuous and systematic. They may go to meetings in Texas, but they're as needed. They're sporadic. And that's not the United States Supreme Court's words, but that's exactly what was happening in Helicopteros. The employees were going there as needed to be trained to work on the helicopters and to fly the helicopters. They were going there as needed to talk about the contract and how the helicopters would be built, a number of meetings. But the contacts were outside in. And that's the difference between Perkins and Helicopteros.
Do you see any distinction between their claims for things that occurred after PAYGO became a Texas organization, such as their claim that you haven't provided them their file and for further attorney's fees?
I mean, I think there could be a distinction between that, but I don't hear because, first, the failure to provide files, I don't believe is a cause of action. I mean, negligent advice is a cause of action. Breach of fiduciary duty in the context of the attorney-client relationship is a cause of action. Failure to provide files may be sanctionable conduct. It may get you sanctioned in a courtroom somewhere, but it's not a cause of action in and of itself. The cause of action arises from negotiating the 2007 CBA and everything related to that. And
aren't
none of
they
that
making a claim based on that, based upon your
claim? I think there's 5.03 of their third amended petition specifically.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say about it is that conduct wouldn't have occurred in Texas. To the extent that Phillips, Campbell, and Phillips, let's spot them that this happened. I'm just assuming this. But let's assume they withheld the files and did not provide them to PAYGO. The files are in Pennsylvania.
Well, let's suppose that we have a Texas resident now, PAYGO, wanting its files, and your failure to deliver that to them, if it is a cause of action, is in Texas. They have to be delivered to the client in Texas.
Yeah, I'm not aware of a case for that single type of allegation that would arise to the level of a specific jurisdiction, because we'd be talking about specific if it's truly tied to an allegation. I'm not familiar with the case holding that is sufficient.
Well, they could argue at least that there's a duty to be performed in Texas to a Texas resident, and you aren't doing it.
Well, but the duty
jurisdiction.
Yeah, but the duty to perform, again, is outside in. The duty to perform is in Pennsylvania. It's a duty to send the files. It happens to be a Texas address you're sending it to, but the duty occurs up in Pennsylvania. And the failure to perform that duty occurs in Pennsylvania. It does not occur in Texas. It occurs in Pennsylvania.
If you delivered it to Oklahoma City instead of to Texas, the duty wasn't in Pennsylvania. It was in Texas. But anyway, we're arguing about a rabbit trail, so let's go ahead.
Yeah, the last thing I would say is the thing that PAYGO has never addressed is the proper standard of review before this court. This court said in Fish versus Tandy Corporation, when a personal jurisdiction question is reviewed, we review all the evidence, but the review is not a de novo review. This court went on to say exactly what the Supreme Court has said. It is factual and legal sufficiency. And PAYGO has never, in any of their briefing, including their reply brief, attacked the evidence for factual and legal sufficiency. What they're simply left with is, are the contacts enough? And the contacts are not enough. They're not enough under specific jurisdiction, and they're not enough under general jurisdiction. We ask that this court affirm the trial court's dismissal.
Couple things need to clear up. There was a claim that there historically has been a poor job done in the representation that would go back, like you said, 4.03 of the petition. There is a claim for that. What we focused on, as stated in the Glencoe case, is the core of the claim. The core of the claim occurred twofold. One, those meetings in 2010, and the subsequent action of not returning information and disclosing confidential information to management of the PGA Tour. One of the things that was mentioned was addressing your question, Justice McCoy, as to when did these board meetings occur, and the answer was, well, the only evidence was as needed. So I look back at Rich Pearson's affidavit on page 2, which was one of the primary affidavits, and it specifically states there were numerous telephonic board meetings. I quote, during these calls, the parties discussed how to handle and react to the loss of an automobile and the automobile insurance, and defendants outlined their plans on how to address these issues. Now, counsel stated, we don't know where Mr. Pearson was during these communications. Well, if you continue reading on page 3, the genesis, analysis, and instructions related to these matters occurred in Texas PAYGO's board in Texas during PAYGO's board meeting and during telephonic board meetings that I attended via telephone at my home in Texas. Certainly evidence from Mr. Pearson's affidavit that he attended these telephonic board meetings in Texas. So I look further with Robbie Ware's affidavit, page 1, relating to, he's a Texas resident as well, his communications. I recall receiving communications regarding the loss of an automobile and automobile insurance from the firm and Mr. Campbell via email. I reviewed these communications while at my home in Texas. Mr. Peterson, Mike Peterson, also an affiant in this case, provided very similar testimony. So to say that there was no testimony as to where this information and this disclosure and communications occurred, that would be wrong. There's clearly evidence, as I've read to you.
Well, let me ask you a question that occurs to me off the top of my head. So you never know what's going to happen then. Wonder what the effect of having personal jurisdiction for purposes of one cause of action is and not others.
That's a very good question. You know, my argument is if you have a claim in one place, you would get them all here, because otherwise you're forced to, in this case, to try breach of fiduciary duty or whatever.
Not exactly.
Here, and then go to Pennsylvania and argue the same facts in a different forum and ultimately get a lack of judicial economy and potentially different results. Because certainly
you don't have any authority to support that, do you?
Not to that question off the top of Justice McCoy's head.
What happens?
I don't have that as we sit here now. No, Your Honor, I do not. But I mean, that would be, you know, my discussion or thought is if you're going to have one here, you might as well try them all in one forum so you don't go around the country arguing the same thing twice. Ultimately, when you get down to it, the duties that Mr. Campbell had and Phillips Campbell and Phillips had continued after termination. He breached those duties. Certainly that was a Texas association at that time. That information wasn't delivered, and here we are in Texas with the claim. Now, I believe we still have information going back to the other points that there was certain very particular and pertinent information that happened here in the state of Texas. It didn't happen in Pennsylvania. There was even some discussion about Florida. It didn't happen there. It happened here. We're not talking about the 2007 collective bargaining agreement where that was negotiated. This was a part of the 2007 collective bargaining agreement, but it was about a unilateral change in 2010 during the term that happened here, not elsewhere. Because of these points, we would ask that the court reverse and remand the case back to the trial court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your very articulate briefs and your obviously well-prepared oral arguments today. Your case is submitted. And at this point, we will adjourn.